continuing with the laws, laws of Manu, then concerning the king, the duties of the king. Text 54. Let him appoint 7 or 8 ministers whose ancestors have been royal servants, who are versed in the sciences, heroes skilled in the use of weapons, and descended from noble families, and who have been tried. 55. Even an undertaking easy in itself is sometimes hard to be accomplished by a single man. How much harder it is for a king, especially if he has no assistant, to govern a kingdom which yields great revenues. So these 8 or 10 ministers, these must be persons who have proven themselves and who are here royal servants, who's have an ancestry of good behavior. That's ideal. Is that in the family lines they've been always supportive of the king and this and that, because then it'll be seen that this is the mood. The mood of the parents very much is reflected in the children. So then, if the parents have always been loyal to authority, then there's a good chance the children will also. But it says here at the end, it says, who have been tried, means that just because the family has been good royal servants doesn't mean that the children are. So when they grow up and you see their activities, then you can understand that they're proper. In other words, others, or maybe you have a devotee who they have been well accepted in other places, like that. So then you know that someone has a good history, like that. He has done nice service in other places and all that. But then it must be, the person must also be tried in your own place, because the place where you are can yield different results. The situation is different. The mentality, therefore, may react differently. So it must be seen that in that situation also, then things are going very nicely. Then you can say that they have good history and you have tried them in the position you have there. Only then they should be given the position, such a position as these ministers. The point is that even something's easy, if it's very voluminous, like doing certain activities may be very easy, but there's a lot of volume of that activity, so one cannot do it himself. So here when it mentions his assistants, they have to have these things. Okay. 56. Let him daily consider with them the ordinary business, referring to peace and war, the 4 subjects called sthana, the revenue, the manner of protecting himself and his kingdom, and the sanctification of his grains by pious gifts. Some here means that these 4 subjects called sthana means the army, the treasury, the town, and the kingdom. So these are the aspects which they must refer to. And these are called the ordinary businesses, referring to peace and war. 57. Having first ascertained the opinion of each minister separately, and then the views of all together, let him do what is most beneficial for him in his affairs. So both aspects are there. What do they think on their own? Because sometimes they won't speak in front of others, or some aspects they want to point out, or you don't want others to know who knows what, who has been let in on what. At the same time is then also together, because then they're working as a team. They must be able to also sit together and discuss together. You have to have these ministers or these close people that are working with have to be people who can work as a group, as a team. Sometimes a modern concept comes up is that on the team you have to have all kinds of people who don't agree with each other, and therefore you'll come up with the right answer. Idea being is that before one person had so much power, and then people didn't like the way it went. So therefore, you make an arrangement that no one can actually get enough power to do anything, right? Like you have a parliament, and you have one side is the majority. So the other side automatically is called the opposition, right? So it doesn't matter what the majority is doing. Even if it's very good for the people, the opposition have to oppose it, because that's what's good for their party. right? And then you prove that those guys are useless, then you get the majority because people then lose faith in the other side. Then you find that now that what was majority before, they're the minority, and now they're the opposition. So like this, they just go on and on. It's a circus. Like this. So the idea is that these must be people who can work together, but they have been proven that they are good character and all these. We can see the king is not working, is working according to good character. That we always must remember that whenever we discuss these fine points, is that first the king must have good qualities. Then only if there's good qualities, then we can discuss that they how they apply this. So these persons must be ones who can work with the king, relate to the chain of authority, of command, and are expert in so many fields. So then they're discussed with privately, and they're discussed with as a group. So that means the king must be very busy and always meeting and talking and discussing with people. This is important. 58. But with the most distinguished among them all, a learned brahmana, let the king deliberate on the most important affairs which relate to the six measures of royal policy. So that means the most distinguished among them, generally the prime minister is generally always a Brahmin who is very expert in these affairs, or the Rajguru. Like that, if he's not managing, then he is in the background, like Vishishta, he was for Lord Ramachandra. They always have the Rajguru, their own, who's a Brahmin, who is very expert in all these things, and then they advise. But that's generally all done in private. So it says, with the most distinguished among them, so privately he would be discussing with them. Let the king deliberate on the most important affairs, just practical affairs, and he deals with all his other royal servants. Let him, full of confidence, always entrust to that official all business. Having taken his final resolution with him, let him afterwards begin to act. So here's an important point, is once he's, because they're there to assist, so once he's come to their resolution. They've discussed, they've come to their point, then the king has to let them act. Right? Just like there may be so many who advise the king, they let the king act. Now the king will discuss with others and then let them act. Right? So the whole point is that you're giving people space. This is a very important aspect. You know, many times, you know, people talk about someone cannot be a bottleneck in the management process. That doesn't work. You have somebody, they've proven themselves, you let them do it. If things aren't going the way you like it, then you can always discuss again and then have it adjusted. You can't have one man there, just like it said, it's foolish to have one man try to run everything. You must do it through assistance. The point is it's getting done through assistance because the assistants are doing it. If the king is there and has his finger on every little detail of everybody, then why didn't he just run it himself? Point is he can't run it himself, because he can't put his finger efficiently on everything. Therefore, he must have trusted people who do it, and he just checks. Specifically, he's checking what the result is. <clears throat> 60. He must also appoint other officials, men of integrity, who are wise, firm, well able to collect money, and well tried. Yeah. Yeah, so here's other persons who are good integrity, wise, firm, and able to collect money. Because that is also a very important aspect. You can go out and actually get people to give their taxes, or get the tax collectors to give their money. So that's very, very important. We see that in the government of Nawab Hussein Shah, then we had Rupa and Sanatan. So one of them was the finance minister, and one was like the home minister. So when the king was out, then one would manage all the affairs of the state, and the other would take care of the treasury. So these are the two most important aspects of the kingdom. So here it says, then others must be appointed for this. So some are there with helping run with the running, then some are here for dealing with all the monies and the treasuries and collection of that revenue. And then you have a very learned person, very learned Brahmana, with which the most important affairs are discussed with him. So these are, we can see already, just the kind of assistance that the king is having, must keep. 61. As many persons as the due performance of his business requires, so many skillful and clever men, free from sloth, let him appoint. So it means you see the workload, and then how many people it takes to actually do that, you put that many people into it. Right? Many times we see nowadays, there's a very nice phenomenon that comes, is you have a certain amount of people, and they somehow or another think that they are supposed to, the ones supposed to do everything. And so any new service comes up, it just goes on their heads again. And then some else of the problem goes on their heads again. And then so many problems come up because no one's actually doing anything, because each one of them has too much for one person to do. Like that. So here it's a matter of how many areas you want to cover. You have to have one person take that nicely. We see, like with Yudhishthira Maharaj and the Rajasuya sacrifice, that you had one person do one important thing. Like, I think Krishna, all he did was collect the shoes. When all the visiting kings come, all he did was see that the shoes were kept and made sure that that king, when he left, got his own shoes back, not somebody else's shoes. Right? Kings don't like to come back. No one likes, but especially kings don't like to come back and find that they got someone else's shoes. Right? And the king doesn't come alone. Right? It'd be easy enough if the king came alone. King comes with all his wives, his ministers, his servants, you know, his generals, his army. So there's quite a few shoes to collect. And it all has to be right. So that's a big, one may say, oh, it's a simple thing, collect the shoes. But just think about it. How many kings, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. So it's no small thing to collect all those shoes. And to see that they're kept nicely and all that. Right? Then I think Bhima, all he did was take care of the food. Right? He's a king. He could run a whole kingdom. But to make sure everything goes nice, he just manages one thing. Just the kitchen. See that the menu is there, what's going on, that it's all being cooked, that it's all being properly, you know, you have to order things, you have to prepare it, you have to cook it. You have to make it ready for serving, see that it's served, wash all the paraphernalia, see that all those persons that are involved in the process, they also eat, and everybody's getting, you know, what they want. And this, it has to be done in royal style, right? You know, that's not just some rice doll. You know, it's something fit for all the kings. So this is very important. So just one person's taking that, Bhima, right? Another one, I think, was Nakula and Sahadev. All they were doing was in bringing the guests in. They would come in, then they would be, their shoes would be put, they would be received at the door, and they would be taken in and shown where they sit. So how to deal with all the kings at all their levels properly, know who they are. You can't know who they are. You have to already know who they are. So that means he has to have all kinds of people who can identify all the kings of the world to come. Right? And then know something about them, and then they have to say something nice, and, you know, something about their kingdom or about the way they do things or something that their particular dynasty is famous for. And then bring them, and then you know where to sit them, right? According to the etiquette. Because you can't have somebody more important sitting in one place and then someone else not more important maybe next to them or in front of them or this. It has to be that all the kings are satisfied, all the etiquette is very proper. That they are sitting in a position according to their place. Right? So one person does this. So when you have like this, then you have a wonderful arrangement. Right? So that's the Vedic culture. Is how much you have that many people. You don't want to keep that many people, then don't do that much stuff. It's that easy. Right? You don't want to have, you don't want to keep much, you don't want to keep much paraphernalia in the kitchen, then don't plan on having big feasts. Right? You have a very small place, don't plan on inviting over, you know, 200 guests. In other words, what facility you have, that much you do, and that's all. If you can only organize and manage, you know, a few servants, then you should keep a very small kingdom. And if you can work with, you know, hundreds of thousands, then you keep a bigger one. So you must be able to do this, choose, know who is good, know how to test that they're good, then know how to deal with them that they remain good, and then, once it's been discussed what they do, delegate it to them. And give them the position, facilities, and the authority to do it. Then that's a leader. Otherwise, if you give the guy, yes, do this, give him no facility, no money, no people to help him, if it takes more than one person, how are they going to get it done? So this is not a manager. Manager knows what it takes to practically do something. Therefore, then they know how to give the people that work under them the facility and support that they require. That's all. So, and they don't mind being straightforward in their dealings like that. Therefore, they discussed with them, and then if it goes the way nicely, all credit goes to that person. If it doesn't, then they'll tell them, something's going wrong here, we have to rediscuss this. Person's very strong on the point, then the king has to make his points or bring it up again and discuss it with all the other ministers or with the Rajguru. Like this. Because he has to take responsibility. Ultimately, he has to take responsibility for all these assistants. So if someone says, oh, this went wrong in your kingdom, the king can't say, well, what can I do? It's this guy. You know? He can't just say it like that. Because then they would say, well, then why do you have him in the position? Well, we put him in the position before, then he went bad. Well, why is he still in the position? Well, I don't have the influence to remove him. Right? So this is not a king. So he has to be able to say, if something's wrong, it's his fault. Because he put the people in the position. He is the one discussing with them. He is the one supporting them. Like that. Therefore, don't manage anything bigger than what you can fully take responsibility for. That's the principle of management we see here. Otherwise, everyone's willing to take management of the whole world. But the point is one should know how much one actually can manage and do that much only, thus. That's all. And if something goes wrong, it's your fault, not someone else's fault. Like that. So this is the principles that are being mentioned here. He mentions here, let him full of confidence always entrust that official. Like that. So he must be convinced. So that means he doesn't have him do it until he's convinced, until other ministers and everybody. But it's a group that can work together. So you don't have a room full of people with opposite opinions, and as soon as this one speaks, that one says the opposite, you know. All they do is, you know, calibrate 180 degrees, and then whatever they said, say the opposite. This is not a kingdom. That's a zoo. Like that. 62. Among them, let him employ the brave, the skillful, the high-born, and the honest in offices for the collection of revenue. In mines, manufacturers, and storehouses, but the timid in the interior of his palace. Okay, so those who are very brave, outgoing, very, you know, strong, skillful, high-born, honest, these things, they'll do these things, collecting of the money, taking care of the mines, because this is where also all your money comes in. You know, they're mining gold or jewels or things like this. You have to have people who are very honest, brave, skillful, high-born, because they have to be able to, because they're going to have to deal with all kinds of unscrupulous people. Because wherever there's money, we have to remember, wherever there's gold, there's Kali. That's where he's allowed to reside. So there's going to be all kinds of people that you wish weren't there. That's why Brahmanas live very simply, very modestly, because they don't want to deal with all this stuff. But they'd rather have nothing than have so many unqualified people coming harassing them because they have money. They'd rather give away all their money and keep nothing, live under a tree, than go through that headache. But a king is willing to do that. And then those Brahmins who have that interest in that area of knowledge, they can deal in these ways. But otherwise, in general, they don't. So this is a major difference. So they have to be, they have to know. So these people must be very dynamic here. Minds manufacturers, because that's also where your economic development is. You have to maintain the standards. You have to see that nobody's stealing. Right? So you must be very strong. Right? You work at a mine so that nobody's stealing. Right? So you have to be very strong. You have to be very dynamic and very skillful. It means you have to know what everybody's doing. And then storehouses. Then wherever everything's being kept, all your grains and everything else, then you have to have people there that know how to scope it. You have to take care of it. It means many of these things take, like grains. You can't just put them there and that's it. You have to see the rats don't get them. You have to see that they're maintained, dried out. So it takes a lot of people. You have a warehouse full of grain that can feed a country. Then that has to be regularly maintained, you know, put in the sun, see that no bugs are in it, and, you know, that your older stocks are being given out, your newer stocks are coming in. It's a big management. So these people must be very skillful and bold, like that. But they must be very honest, and that's due to and high-born. Because the high-born generally means that they will be, I say high-born means the natural characteristics they have. Right? Is that the characteristics they have, they naturally have good character. So you can trust that even on a bad day, they're still going to be good. Right? I mean, somebody from a very bad qualities, if they're very Krishna conscious, then they're behaving very nice, the sadhus. But on a bad day, then they may be a little below the standard. Right? Like that. So you have to see someone has naturally good qualities. Right? This is why you have to look into what is behind this. What is the purpose? Here it says high born. Okay, so when you're dealing in, you know, Malecha culture, then just that one's in the culture means low born. Right? So here, what is the purpose of the high born? The high born means they're going to have a natural stock of pious qualities. So therefore, you must be looking for someone that has natural good qualities. This is the purpose here. Right? Because otherwise, then some will read this and go, oh, well, nowadays nobody's high-born, so let's just throw the whole thing out. Right? But what is the purpose of the high-born? The purpose of the high-born is that they have the good qualities. Right? Like that. They're high-born, generally you'll see that they are honest. Right? But if they're high-born and not honest, they're not taken. The goal is you want them to be honest. And you want that honesty to be based on a natural good character. So therefore, the high-born. So high-born can either mean born from a high family or with their birth, they are full of high qualities. Right? They're born high. Right? Like that. So it's one must see what is the purpose behind these things. Otherwise, too easily we can just say, oh, it doesn't apply to this age. But it's been pointed out before is these rules applied from the beginning of creation, and they'll be useful up to the last day of the dissolution. Right? They're good up to the, you know, up to the last, you know, evening of Lord Brahma. And then when Lord Vishnu breathes back in, then you don't have to worry about Manasamita, because everyone's going to sleep for, you know, another, that however long Brahma was manifest, that long they're going to sleep. You don't have to worry about it then. But as soon as Mahavishnu breathes out again, these laws have some meaning. So if we can't find how to apply them, it means because we're not understanding what's behind them. So we have to try to understand what's there. Because any system of organization, if you don't understand it, will fail. There's nothing that will just work whether it's understood or not, other than animalistic qualities. So human qualities mean they must be trained, so that means they must be understood. So we always have to be very careful. Okay, but the timid in the interior of his palace. So in other words, those who are humble and those who are going to be very sensitive to everything around them, they can work on the interior of the palace. Because they have to be very sensitive to these things. They can't be bold and walk strutting around and cutting a profile. That's necessary when you're outside. Because people have to respect, this person is powerful, He's knowledgeable, he's skilled, he has good qualities, so therefore he's very strong. I can't mind because he's such a properly cultured person. Well, in the palace, then they must be very timid. Because in there, they must be very sensitive to what's going on, if they're supposed to go into a room or not. They have a duty in a room. Then they can't be bold there. They have to see, is it the right time? Should I go in? Should I not? You know, if need be, they'll wait. So they have that kind of patience. They have that mood. It doesn't mean that they're not expert. It just means that they are very, 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 how do you say, just very humble. Like that. 63. Let him also appoint an ambassador who is versed in all sciences, who understands hints, expressions of the face and gestures, who is honest, skillful, and of noble family. So this ambassador is someone who goes, he must know all sciences, because everywhere you go, then every kingdom, they're going to be trained in various sciences. And you have to be able to discuss with them whatever they're going to discuss. Like you'll see, the different kings, according to their interests, some is going to be more into Sanskrit, some into philosophy, some into the Dharma Shastras more, some into the Puranas. So they're going to be giving, you know, someone's in the Puranas, they may be quoting from, well, you know, like in this story of, you know, this king and in this occasion, you know, as in the, in this Purana. And if you don't know it, you're not going to understand what he's talking about. And then he's going to think, what? You don't know this? You know, and then what is your king? You know, you haven't learned these things? Because it's quite natural that someone's going to feel that what they know is the most important thing. You don't know it, then they say you don't know anything. So whatever the other king's going to talk on, you have to know what he's talking about. Like that. Therefore it says, who is versed in all sciences. It means he must know everything. Like that. Then, who understands hints. Means from his own king, because many times as the king may not have the opportunity to discuss privately. Right? So he's going to be discussing in the court this, that. So he wants things that he wants them to do. He may not want others to fully understand. He may want them to, he may not. So he himself must be able to use hints. Hints, expressions of the faces and gestures. And that ambassador must know what he's talking about. Or it may be the ambassador is naturally the person when you have these big kings and others come from other places. The ambassador, because he's gone out, he knows those people. He's going to be the one that's sitting there and introducing and this and that. And so he must also understand hints, expressions of the face and gestures, so that the king wants him to do something, he knows what he's supposed to do. Like that. And when this ambassador goes out to other kingdoms, he must be able to understand there from the king. So when the king is saying something, he must understand, oh, this is not going to go well, I don't pursue this, and then change the subject, move this way, that way. Or the king may be in a similar kind of, he may be in a problem. He may have ministers or others who are trying to take his position, and this and that. He can't speak openly, so then he has to understand this. Or he must know what all this means, that, okay, the king is very good, but he has this bad minister here. And so the area that I want to get done is controlled by this minister, so it doesn't matter what the king says, this guy's going to make trouble. So he has to be very sensitive to whatever's going on. So he must know all this. And then who is honest, he also must be honest, because he must represent the king. So generally, you'll see many times in this that that's also a Brahmin is many times the person who does this. That they carry the messages, they do all these things. Like when Rukmini sent a message to Krishna, she sent it with a Brahmin. That they would come and speak all these things. Plus, generally, Brahmins will not be disturbed, so if the... Sometimes when they come and they speak things that the other king says, so the other king may get upset with it, that generally then the messenger, especially because they're a Brahmin, then they can't be chastised or punished, you know, like that. Speak loudly.
Yeah, because Akrura was a very elder member of the family.
just that always being around all these bad association, then he got himself involved in that, you know, that whole thing with the Sherman Chuck and Jewel. But otherwise, he was a great devotee and all this. So that's the point, is there must be someone who can do this. So generally you'll see it'll be a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, like that. We see the, many of the qualities that have been mentioned here. It says here in these ministers who are versed in the sciences, so that means they're very educated. Heroes skilled in the use of weapons. So then this would generally be referring to Kshatriyas here, and descended from noble families. Right? So noble also generally means royalty. But besides that, he has his Brahmins. Yes.
So this means because generally a king has many sons, so but only one of them becomes the king. So is it often that his other sons or the other princes become ministers?
Can become like that. They can also be other parts of the family, you know, other or just or different groups, like we see there that time when Krishna was there, you had the Vrishnis and the Bhojas and Andakas and all that, and they're all considered within that Kuru clan, you know, like that. But it's all because they all intermarriage and all these kind of things. So like that, it's not that they don't necessarily become the king; they may become smaller kings. You may take just like Ramachandra's kingdom that's divided into half between Lava and Kush. So one sat in Mathura; that was his capital. I think the other one sat in Ayodhya. So like that, they may do like that also. But there'll be more Kshatriyas involved, so there'll be ministers, or they'll take up different areas. Main thing is that the point is they have their area of jurisdiction. Brahmins, Kshatriyas are independent, so they have their area of jurisdiction. Therefore, the king, it says, let him full of confidence always entrust to that official all businesses. Right? Having taken his final resolution with him, let him afterwards begin to act. So that means is they have their space. Just like the Pandavas. They said, okay, we don't mind. You don't want to give us a kingdom, just give us 5 villages. And we'll live by managing those villages and taking the tax from that village. Right? So then we don't mind that we're that small. You know, is that our kingdom is as big as one village. You know, which is not very big, a few kilometers like that. You know, you have the village and you have the surrounding agricultural land. So that's all they were taking. That's they're satisfied. Like that. But Duryodhana didn't even want to give that. It shows he's a rascal. You know, he doesn't understand the nature of kings. Kings have to have a space. Right? And they were behaving nicely. It wasn't that they weren't. It wasn't that they were aggressive or anything like that. So we see that Parikit, he even is giving Kali a space because he's surrendered. So here the Pandavas said, you know, we don't mind. You take the whole kingdom. We'll be subservient to that. Just you give us 5 villages. That's all. He wouldn't give that. So it shows he's not actually a qualified Kshatriya Duryodhana. Like that. Because he doesn't know how to behave. He's too aggressive. He's caught up in these, you know, gambling and all these things. The points mentioned before, the faults, the 8 faults coming from anger and the 10 faults coming from, you know, the desire for enjoyment. So he was very caught up in all those things. Like that. Here, skillful and of noble family, so that may also mean Kshatriya. Like that. Yeah.
Yes. Sometimes also allow them to do something that you may not do, and let them learn from the mistake.
It just depends upon what's the situation. If it's a very, very sensitive situation, you can't do that. It's got to be right. And if it's a very minor, then because generally that is done before while they're being tried. They're tested already in that way, and then they see the mistake, and then this and that. But here you're talking about your 7 or 8 best managers of the kingdom. So you don't have to do that with them. They're not new. But the people working under them, they may work like that. But the thing is you have to have someone who is very qualified to learn from their mistakes. That also is there. See, the concept comes up is that the person on top must be always broad-minded, this and that. So they must have qualities. But now if there's going to be a relationship with the person that is junior to them, then that person must also have qualities. Therefore, the modern concepts are fully impersonal because they only look at it from one side. They only look at it from, generally, from the side of the leader, what they must be like. They don't talk about the follower. They say the follower must have qualities also. Then if they don't, then what's going to happen? They have to go somewhere else. Like that. But it's understood, those people who are good in things, who actually make things happen, they know this. Someone's not good, they fire them. Someone's good, they keep them or encourage them. You know, give them a better position, give them a better facility, like that. But we have this sometimes an idea, an unrealistic idea, is that the top's got to be so wonderful it's going to make me just become nice, right? But that is there, but I have to have the potential to become nice in a practical amount of time. Okay, maybe I'll become nice in 3 lifetimes, but the problem is we have a situation that needs to be filled now. You know, and maybe, you know, you have a very short time to kind of get it together. Is that making sense? Like that, because generally you don't hear so much of that discussion in the management circles. It means when there's kind of like the books on this or classes on this. Sometimes they'll refer to this, but generally they're always talking about the leader. But that's okay if that's only being discussed with leaders. But nowadays, everything must be discussed very openly amongst everybody. Everybody's got to hear and have a part to say. Therefore, everybody must be qualified. Right? Means you can have a book, see, like many write a book on management, but that book is to be read by managers. So that's okay. Then he can only talk about managers. But if you're going to have something that's going to be generally discussed, then you must be dealing with people who are qualified. Because if he doesn't have the potential, then how they'll come up. You know? Therefore, we hear that story, the one about there's the king, the minister, and then the laborer. And the laborer is wondering why this minister gets so much facility, gets so much honor, and everything like that. I mean, and the labor thinks, well, I'm very, you know, expert also. So what's so special about him? So then, you know, this complaint comes to the king. So the king goes, okay. So we will give a task to both you and the minister. And I want the results of that test by tomorrow morning. So he says, the test is, I want to know how much does the royal elephant weigh. Exactly. Not an estimate. I want exact weight. Like that. So then they both, you know, bow their heads and excuse themselves and go off. Then the next morning, the laborer is called in. And the king asks if he knows, and he says he doesn't. Because he's been working on, you know, since the day before, how are we going to... He was trying to find a set of scales that were big enough to stick the elephant on. You know, and he couldn't find. You know, and none of his friends and everybody else, this and that. And then he called on the minister. And the minister said, oh, yes. You know, he said, he weighs exactly this much. And they said, well, how did you come to that point? He says, it was very easy. We took the royal elephant down to the river. And we had a barge there. And we put the elephant on the barge. Then we took a marker and marked the water level at the boat, where the boat sat. Then we took the elephant out of the barge, and then we put weights onto the boat until it went sunk into the water to the level of where the water mark was. So therefore, you know the royal elephant weighs exactly this much. So then the king turned to the laborer and says, now do you understand why he's the minister and you're the laborer? So then the case was settled, like this. So they must have great qualification. It's not enough that just one has the emotional interest to do something, you know, especially leadership. There must be the qualification. Therefore, if you have somebody that can learn by doing something wrong and then be shown that it was wrong, and then they understand. In other words, they were attempting to do an activity through some detail. It was not working. Then it's pointed out to them how it doesn't work, and then they understand the principle behind it. You're talking about a very qualified person. That's why managers are actually very rare. Like that. Because managers means they understand the principles. And then they can apply that principle in a variety of detailed situations according to their ability. You know, the greater the ability, then the more broad the spectrum they can work in. And less than the less. But the point is they all understand the principle. Therefore, when you talk management with managers, they all basically talk the same language. Like that. So therefore, when somebody comes up with a nice way to explain it, then they all appreciate it. Because this has been very nicely articulated. I've always thought like that. But this person has said it. You know? Like that. Because they can see it comes from experience. And like that. So that is naturally done in the training. And, you know, or in not so important things. If you see that here's a person that you want to bring up to a higher level, the king may do those kind of things, or the minister may do those kind of things, but they already have to have something of caliber to work with in the first place. Like that. That's also very important. Otherwise, you know, the modern situation where it's just because you don't trust anyone else, therefore you want to be, you know, part of the team. That's not good enough. You yourself also have to know what's going on and be able to manage. Otherwise, it's just going to be one fiasco after another. And you can see it going on even today. Is that people who can't manage put themselves into positions of manage because they can talk nicely. But it doesn't mean that any results ever come out of it. But because you have so many non-managers, no one notices. Like that. Yes.
The thing there is that the law says that they'd need to understand the qualification of the different manas so they know how they can actually use people.
Yes,
so
yes.
One thing I'm realizing, I'm working with Sudra mentality at the moment. Uh-huh. And I'm learning a lot about the nature of Sudra mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that there's, you know, what you can expect and what you can't expect.
Oh, yeah.
So a king would have to know basically all of the moves and how to engage them.
Yes. Yes, that's very important. That's why all the whole Dharma Shastra specifically learned, the kings have to learn it. And then those Brahmins, generally the Brahmins also learn, but those who like specialize in the subject are those who have interest in the field who can work with Brahmins like that. Though it is just an interesting area of study. Like Chanakya, he was just a Brahmin. But then when it came to seeing that the king was not qualified, therefore he exercised the knowledge that he knew and then reestablished a new king. Like that. So for the Brahmins, it's just, they, means the best is you learn something that is, that then you use that in Krishna's service. Like that. So that's the actual Krishna, that's the actual purpose of the scriptures. But otherwise you see a nicely qualified Brahmin, even if he's not a devotee, he'll have the area of knowledge, but he's not proud of that, so he doesn't have to apply it to prove it to anybody. Someone comes and asks, he knows. They don't ask, he doesn't, you know. I mean, he just sits with it. If they're unqualified, then they must show everybody, like these Digvijay pundits and all that. These are not very qualified. They know their subject well, but character-wise, they're not very qualified. Because they must prove to everybody that they are knowledgeable. Why they can't just sit in their own village and with that knowledge and become elevated. But they have to go out and prove that they're very advanced. Like that. So So the Kshatriyas and the Brahmins, they would learn this science very, very nicely. That way they could deal, because they deal with the whole society. Like that. Your Vaishya and Shudras doesn't necessarily have to occupationally deal with the whole strata of the social society, while the other two do. and they don't necessarily have to lead it like that. While the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, by nature, they have to be able to lead it. They must have good character. You know? So, well, your point is very, very important, that they must know all the mentalities and all this and how to deal and all. Therefore, they know who to engage, how much, what to expect from them. That. Then from that, then they can figure out who has the real potential and then train them to a very high level.
That also means those that don't have that potential can be properly situated and satisfied in their areas.
Yeah, yes. They can, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned yesterday that the two higher classes, they work, they have to, they can only work by their own core personal qualities, because the lower classes, if they have the expertise in business or some art, they can always do well. So, is it talking about like Brahmins, is that Brahmins are expert in particular fields of knowledge, like Sanskrit or whatever. So in case of devotees, is it like important, if they want to engage such a specific knowledge in Krishna service, they have to have very good personal qualities. Otherwise, it's very, you know, they get proud of them and difficult for them to practically use them.
Devotee means that they have good qualities. Mm. So, in the whole process of devotional service, anartha nivritti is there, which means one's going to consciously work on removing the anarthas from the heart. And as soon as one does that, or I mean, at least starts to begin that process consciously, then one sees that his devotional life improves at that time. Things start to work. Like that. Before that, there's so many unseen and unknown difficulties that come up because of the obstacles of bad qualities. Like that. So we're trying to work in the field of devotional service. What amount of bad qualities may be there in the heart of the devotee may be fine for working in the material world. But for working in the spiritual context, then you know, any bad quality shouldn't be there. So it should be at least consciously recognized and one's working on removing it. Therefore we see the acharyas in their songs, they're always talking about, they see their own bad qualities. And we can understand from these prayers that they're on very elevated platforms of realization. But they're still talking about the bad qualities they see in their own heart. Like Madhavendra Puri is the, you know, topmost personality. And he would like to offer this nice kheer at Gopinath's temple to his deity in Vrindavan. But then he sees in himself the bad quality. He is interested himself to eat the item because it wasn't even offered yet. You know, he's eating some of the kheer, you know, that's offered, and he's thinking about, I'd like to see how they, or no, excuse me, he hears about it, he'd like to taste it. He hears about it, he'd like to taste it. So he's thinking in the future. So then he thinks, this hasn't even been offered, and already I want to eat it, so what a nonsense I am. So then he just leaves the temple. He feels himself too unqualified to even be there in the temple, so he just leaves. Right? But because there was no material motive, there was no bad quality, the devotee perceives bad qualities in themselves even though they don't even have them. Right? This is the interesting thing, is the Uttamadhikari, even though he has no bad qualities, still perceives bad qualities in himself. So then, and it's not that they're just doing that just to set the example. That is, they're just, that's naturally the way they feel.
Now, you just mentioned, when you were reading, you just mentioned about the eight faults that come from anger and some that come from desire for sense gratification.
Mm.
Can you recap on what they are?
They were... this text 45. Let him carefully shun the 10 vices springing from love of pleasure and the 8 proceeding from wrath, which all end in misery. For a king who is attached to the vices springing from love of pleasure, he loses his wealth and his virtue. But he who is given to those arising from anger loses even his life. So those are even worse. So these are the 10 from love of pleasure. Hunting, gambling, sleeping by day, censoriousness, excess with women, drunkenness, and inordinate love for dancing, singing, and music, and useless travel are the tenfold set of vices springing from love of pleasure. Then, tale-bearing, violence, treachery, envy, slandering, unjust seizure of property, reviling, and assault are the eightfold set of vices produced by wrath. That greediness which all men declare to be the root even of both these sets, let him carefully conquer. Both sets of vices are produced by that. So now in the love of pleasures, then drinking, gambling, excesses with women, and hunting. These four have been enumerated in succession. He must know to be the worst in the set that springs from love of pleasure. You know, in that order. Huh? Yeah. It's interesting, right? Drinking, gambling, illicit sex, and meat eating. But here they go out and kill what they eat first. They don't just go down to the Kmart and buy it, right? That's interesting. 51, then, doing bodily injury, reviling, and the seizure of property. These three he must know to be the worst in the set produced by wrath. So that's the... Yeah, it says it's between vice and death, no vice to be worse. That's the next one. Because a person who is tends towards vice sinks into hell. But he who dies free from vice then is elevated. Like that. So sometimes it may be said, well, doing something wrong is better than dying. But sometimes it's not. You know? So that has to be seen. Okay, 64. Such an ambassador is commended to a king who is loyal, honest, skillful, possessing a good memory, and who knows the proper place and time for action, who is handsome, fearless, and eloquent. So these are all more good qualities. Good memory, you can't forget people's names, right? Very bad. What was your name? You can't do that kind of stuff. Proper place and time for action. Who, he says here, handsome, looks nice, because if someone looks very good, it's naturally then people are attracted, and it's taken as a sign of piety, like that. Fearless, because they're going to be in some very difficult situations. You know, you're going to another kingdom and you're basically putting yourself in their hands, and you're just trusting that they're going to be of good character to behave with you properly. And eloquent, they must be able to speak very nicely and sweetly, so even if things are a little tense or strained, they have to be able to speak in such a way that the people will be pleased. In other words, you know, they can talk their way out of a difficult situation. Right? Or they can present something very nicely. The king has something to say and they're representing that, and they speak it in such a way it's accepted by the other party because it's spoken so nicely. Yeah, diplomacy is there, but here it's also just the ability to speak nicely. They can present nicely. Loyal, honest, skillful, we already mentioned, but here the new things are good memory. But notice that this is discussed again. Loyal, honest, skillful. These ones are mentioned from before. So they've been said twice, so these are very important. Loyalty is the most important, and honesty, skillful. If they're not loyal, the whole thing falls apart. If they're not honest, it falls apart. If they're not skillful. But that's the order. Like in these previous slokas, many times it's mentioned from the most important to the least important. That's generally the Vedic. Like the Vedic, generally when it discusses the the adhikari of the devotee. It starts with uttama. And then once you understand what's the you know, best standard, then it goes to madhyama, then it goes to kanishta. So generally in the Vedic, it'll always talk the best, the next best, and then the worst. So here also then, loyalty is most important, honesty, skillfulness, then a good memory, knows the proper time, place, and circumstance for action, then is handsome, fearless, eloquent. Like this. 65. The army depends upon the official placed in charge of it, the due control of the subjects on the army, the treasury and the government of the realm on the king, peace and its opposite war on the ambassador. Yeah. So here, as we see, So the general in charge of the army is depending upon that. Then the control of the subjects will be because the army is there. Because the army is generally what is used. It means previously the army would do all these activities of like what nowadays the police do, the constables and all that. It would just be the army personnel. Like that. What do you say? The treasury and the government of the realm on the king. Means the whole administration that he's given it to all these people, and therefore the treasury. So that means one side is doing the practical, one side is doing the revenue. So that's dependent on the king. The king is not expert, then it's not going to work. He's not going to have qualified people. He's not going to pick qualified people. He's not going to be able to properly use his money or guard his money like this. And if you don't have revenue and all this, you don't have an army. This is important. You don't have a treasury, you don't have an army. Because all that army has to be fed and maintained. Like that. So there must be revenue. Like that. So if you don't have that, then you don't have anything. Peace in its opposite war on the ambassador. The ambassador doesn't speak properly or doesn't represent properly, then you may have war. He does, he can avert war. You have peace. So the ambassador is very, very important. 66. For the ambassador alone makes kings allies and separates allies. The ambassador transacts that business by which kings are disunited or not. So the ambassador, by how he speaks, will bring kings together or split them. Right? The ambassador goes and let's say there's a king, another king, and he's not very, he's maybe allies with another. And those both are inimical to his own king. So he may go and by speaking, he may split those two kings up. Either they split them up so that they now as two individuals, then they're less powerful than his own king. Or because they're fighting amongst themselves, they lose their power. Or he brings one king over to be allies with his own king. And that leaves the other one left on his own. So in either case, he is able to bring them together or split them apart for the benefit of his own kingdom. Right? Like this. So it's very important. So how they speak and how they present, then they bring things together or split things up. You know, or create war or create peace. So very important. So a very qualified person must be there. Very qualified. Okay. 67. With respect to the affairs, let the ambassador explore the expression of the countenance, the gestures, the action of the foreign king, through the gestures and actions of his confidential advisors, and discover his designs amongst his servants. Like that. So the foreign king, how he acts and behaves and gestures and his facial expression, and those who come with the king. The king doesn't come alone, as we discussed before. He'll come with a whole entourage. So then he must be able to tell what them also. The king may be speaking all very nice things, but if from the entourage he gets a whole different flavor, then he knows the king's not speaking truth. Right? Because the king discusses with all his people. Like that. Right? Unless they're letting on and they're planning to take over. But that's, you know, rare thing. But otherwise, one can see what is there. So the king may be very expert, or his entourage may be very expert in speaking, but by their countenance, by their gestures, you're going to understand that there's something wrong here. Right? Therefore, the ancient science of body language was known by them. Huh. Yes. What's not connected? The point is that before applying it, it has to be connected. Because if you get something from somewhere, it has come to us through some it's been filtered through. In other words, it's just like a devotee. He may know so many things and do so many things, but as soon as he kind of loses some Krishna consciousness, his service becomes polluted. So eventually we know all these arts and sciences go back to the Vedic culture. Because all there was on the planet was Vedic culture before. So whatever, and if one has read history, then one can see the similarities that are there, you know, in all over the world. And like even in England, the Celts, then they worshipped a goddess that was in charge of money. And she would sit there, and she would have two elephants that would sit next to her holding lotuses in their trunks. So anyone who knows a little bit about the Vedic culture knows this is Dhana Lakshmi. And if they know a little bit about geography and that, they know that there are no elephants in England. Huh? Yeah, no lotus flowers either. Right? And generally no ladies sitting on them. Right? So from this we can understand is the whole culture, Vedic culture, is spread all over the world. So whatever is left that works, it's coming down through these improperly filtered channels. So now the difficulty comes if you take just what someone gives, it will be coming and it's been given to us through a particular mood, that they have a particular goal of control and enjoyment that they want to establish. And they know ways to get it done. Then you go to them, you learn from this. Now if you take it just as it is and just apply it like that, without connecting it to Krishna, then one will get the same result they get. Which means maybe material prosperity, but no Krishna consciousness. So it has to be connected with Krishna. So now the wonderful thing about connecting things to Krishna, even if things are in the modes of passion or ignorance, they can be connected to Krishna and Krishna will accept them. But one has to see the actual connection and use our own culture. It means the person presents it, and to apply it there may be some mundane pride and some mundane desire for control and position. Right? Because that's generally why people go to these conferences anyway. Is they're in a position, but they want to get higher in the position, or they want to become more expert in their position so they can get more out of it. Therefore they go and learn these courses, isn't it? They're fully satisfied, why they would go to the course. But they want to get more. So if one doesn't convert this into doing it for Krishna, so even if there are some rough qualities, then it will not give proper benefit. No one will be satisfied. Even though it's seemingly used in his service, but you're not seeing the connection. And if you use the qualities that they discuss, in the beginning, if one's very neophyte, that may be okay, but that has to be purified, because Krishna is not looking for material expertise, he's looking for devotion. So management anyway, expertise is only the modes of nature. The reason that the big guy today is managing nicely is because the modes of nature are allowing him to manage nicely. And that because of previous pious deeds. Otherwise, he's not doing the management, he's not the doer. It's not the devotees are not the doer, but the karmis are. So the karmis think they are. Therefore they take the credit. And they get the reaction. Well, the devotee doesn't. So one has to at least convert the culture of it, even though he may use the technique as it is. Does that make sense? But he's using it for Krishna's service, without his own gain. Because the karmis is using it for their own gain. So if you go and associate with them, you might pick that up. So one has to be very cautious of that. So you can take the technique, but not the culture of how they apply it. that always has to be converted. No question that it cannot be converted. Unless one is just, you know, the beginning stages of devotional service. Then anything's better than nothing. But one shouldn't try to, you know, lead, at least the Krishna consciousness movement. Because one doesn't have won't have the character. As we see here, a leader means character. That's the first principle. Like that. So then, if one can then convert it back to its original Vedic form, then that means one understands fully the science, how it works. So that's always the best. But if one can't do that, but at least one knows it works, and one does it in proper Krishna conscious attitude, for the pleasure of Krishna, you know, and without disturbing others, then it's also perfect. That's the point, is whether it's, whatever it's coming from, it's engaged in Krishna's service. It's perfect. It's sat. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So converting it back to the original Vedic source and understanding the principles.
Yes, understanding the principles. Because the detail, even the Vedic thing, you have a modern king nowadays, you know, there's every chance they'll be using a telephone. You know, they're going to have a modern standing army and weaponry. They're going to be, you know, sending their ministers out in three-piece suits. They're going to be doing all those kind of things. Right? So then, means like Prabhupada talked about, what's his name? Subhas Chandra Ghosh. That he was a Kshatriya and he was God conscious. And he was trying to raise money for an army. He saw that the politicians, and they were going about it, you know, in a political way, and there was going to be no solution. So then he wanted to be a little more practical. So he was trying to raise an army. Like that. And he wasn't just, you know, looking around for a bunch of guys with swords. He went off to Japan, that side, to try to get funds and everything like that together. So it'll be used like that. So the point is the principle you have to know. Then you can convert it into the detail of the modern day. Like that. So principle is the most important. Because then it makes it very easy to convert it. Because generally you'll see someone who does know the science very well, if you know the Vedic science very well and discuss it, they'll be very, very interested, intrigued. Oh, this is ancient, this, that, and they see that the principles are the same. They'll be very happy. You know, I've generally never seen anyone who is very expert at something not be happy with hearing the Vedic explanation. You know, I generally find more opposition to the Vedic explanation amongst devotees than I find with, you know, academics and people who actually know how to move the material nature around.
Isn't it also very important to have an understanding of the consciousness behind the principles?
Yes.
Because last year I was working on a management manual, which was obviously based on Kovi's principles and things.
Hmm.
And one thing that really struck me in it as a devotee was that there was no discussion or concern with dealings between managers.
Hmm.
Especially at higher leadership level. It was very much... There's a very strong Gyan influence there, controllership and independent controllership.
Mm.
I raised it with a person concerned. I didn't get a reply to that.
Generally not, because most of these things are coming up for economics.
Mm.
These books aren't written specifically for, you know, you generally don't find the prime ministers and the presidents and the kings and, you know, whatever, the sovereigns of state. The books generally aren't written for them. The books are more written for those who are the economic managers of the state. They're the ones that are mostly what they're written for, because they're, you know, and or those people who want to get to that position. Because they're writing the book to make money, you know. If they were writing the book not to make money, then you know, just for educational sake, then you would generally see a different pattern go. You wouldn't see that after they've written a book, then they go on tours and make $50,000 an appearance to speak, right? Like that. So you can see that even though there's their good intention on one side, that they want to share the knowledge and this and that, they're also, you know, they're not economically foolish. They are making a buck out of it. So the whole point as we discussed before, was that the Vedic concept of explanation is the person who's going to be the most preeminent in that area, you describe that whole area through that person or that situation. Therefore, everybody's managing to some degree, but the one who epitomizes the manager is the king, the kshatriya. But businessmen are managing, artists are managing, you know, the family is doing their management of the household. The Brahmin is also managing all his different, you know, affairs of teaching or preaching or puja. But it's like it's seen in its most fully manifested form with the king. Therefore, all the details are discussed there. But the principles behind it are applicable even in the house. Like that. In other words, here, the husband discusses very nicely with the wife, and then what is her areas of doing, then with confidence he lets her do it. You know? Because, you know, loyalty is there, and honesty is there, and skillfulness and expertise, and all these different things we've discussed are there. So with confidence, and also the wife discussed there, and the husband does his areas, and she with confidence like that. So that's the whole point of leading, is that these principles are there. But it's discussed through the, how you say, the king. Just like all the different rules and regulations in your daily activities, the whole gauntlet of it is discussed through the grihasthas. Because by nature, that is their service, is engaging all these in the Lord's service. You know, they're eating, they're sleeping, they're mating, they're defending. These are very prominent in the life, and they must engage these in the Lord's service. Therefore, they're all described through them. Like that. Brahmacharya also eats. It's not that the rule is there that you must eat with the grihastha eats with his right hand, the prasad, that the brahmacharya doesn't have to. No, they also do. But you don't explain it there. With the brahmacharya, you discuss with them, you know, menial service, surrender to guru, that relationships that there with guru, how the guru is respected. You don't see it discussed with the grihastha. Maybe one verse, two verses maximum. You know, just on in the area of receiving guests, then they'll say, okay, when your teacher comes, if it's been after a long time, then you formally receive him. If it's been after a short time, then that formality is not so important. Other than that, it's not. But the full actual rasa in dealing is discussed with the brahmacharya and the teacher. But that goes for everybody. That one of the verses before said that a wise person performs all these. Whatever previous rules have been discussed, it doesn't matter the varna or ashram. The principles everybody follows. Just the details different. The details different. Like that. So therefore, in the Vedas, then we'll discuss the kings, their relationship with the kings, and then the relationship with everybody else. And then you take the same principles, and then you can apply it in business. It's like in Japan. Japan is known for, at least was known for, quite expert business people like that. So now, what is the book that they read? Right? Because they're not reading Kavi and other people like that. They're reading a text from the 1700s called the Book of Five Rings. And that Book of Five Rings is about how to fight with the sword. Like that. It was written by, what is it, Musashi? And he was the most expert, you know, renowned swordsman in, you know, whatever it is, the contemporary history of Japan. So those same principles, so expert businessmen, they can see the principles behind it, and then they use that in how they run their businesses. And they deal in this and that. Because they're also, the samurais, they had a code. Bushido, how they would deal with each other, that the qualities, they would work by good qualities, loyalty, all these different things were there. So you see that their whole companies and that are based on these. Loyalty to the company, all the different things, they did something wrong, it's bad for the company. They feel very bad. You know, I mean, it's a whole different thing. So it's based on just the qualities. So they've done it on there. So the Vedic system is that from all these, then from there you can do it down into the lower levels. Like that. It's just wherever management needs to be done, these are the principles. You don't have to take the details as far as this, but the principles have to be applied. Is that?
And the consciousness behind it.
Yeah, and the consciousness, that's the most important. Means for us, we always must also remember is that this must always be taken in the Krishna conscious framework. When we're talking about Brahman, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, this means the conditioned nature. Because a devotee is transcendental to these things. But they have a conditioned nature. And that nature is according to these varnas and ashrams. So that has to be engaged in Krishna service accordingly. But otherwise, devotional service is the real thing. Ultimately, we're not worried about varnashram. We use varnashram as a tool to engage our conditioned nature in Krishna service. And we want to engage in Krishna service, develop love for Krishna. That's our goal. But we realize we have a conditioned body and a conditioned subtle body. So we engage those in Krishna service. So that's a very important thing. Many times devotees think, well, this is external. It's not important. External is not important as long as you only work on the internal. If you're on the platform of bhava, then the externals of varnashram don't mean anything, unless you want to preach. Others see your externals, so therefore you follow them. But if we're not on the platform of bhava, we happen to be below that standard, then we are conditioned and we must engage our nature. We must engage. That was the point that was so confusing to Arjuna. He's doing his duties of a kshatriya. He sees there's going to be a bad result. He wants to not do it. Then Krishna tells him he's a fool and gives all kinds of nice spiritual directives. And then Arjuna thinks, great, I'll go to the forest. And then Krishna says, no, you didn't understand. And then Arjuna says, well, I'm bewildered. You say, you know, give up this materialistic mentality and the fruit of results and all these different things. And then you also say, don't go to the forest. So I don't know what to do. All Krishna is saying is you do your duty according to your nature, but do it for Him. So that's what we see as a result at the end of the Gita. Is that He's still doing whatever He was supposed to have done in the first chapter. Now He's doing it in the 18th chapter. You know? It just took 17 chapters in between to make that happen. So, basically, if you took Krishna takes Arjuna goes out into the middle of the battlefield, observes the armies there, and then he tells Krishna to bring it back. He goes back into formation, and then he fights. Right? That should have been what happened. But unfortunately, he misunderstood how to engage his service and his nature in Krishna's service. Therefore, then the whole, all those chapters in between, then were spoken, so that Arjuna now was ready to fight. So this point must be understood as though it is external. But that's the point: is we are so conditioned to this body that we think we are the body. Therefore, practically every lecture that Prabhupada gave, he said, we're not this body. Or we're not this mind, or we're not this intelligence, or we're not this ego. So generally, someone who can give up all that, that's a very, very elevated platform. It's called Brahma-Bhuta. So the devotee, knowing the process of devotional service, then engages his conditioned nature in Lord's service. And in the beginning he may be attached to the fruits, but as he advances, then he's not attached to the fruits. But he likes doing the particular service that matches his conditioned nature. Therefore, someone has the ability to manage here, like the king, he will do managing for Krishna. So that must always be remembered. Like that. That's why in the very beginning of this text, it says this science should not be taught to people who themselves are not advanced. So, you know, that is a point here. Is those who are not qualified, they shouldn't learn this science because they'll misunderstand it or misuse it. But the point is based on Krishna conscious principles, then one must learn and apply these material principles in Krishna's service. That is that. So it's a very, very good point. The Vedic thing is it's relationship. Everything's relationship. Just like this morning, yeah, everything's relationship. So you have to know all the different things. Like he keeps mentioning loyalty. Mentions as assistants, servants. Like that. It means, what is their relation with the king? You know, and it points out the relationships here. You know, army depends on the official. So that's the relationship there. Then the subjects and their proper behavior on the army. Then the treasury and the government on the king. Right? And then whether there's peace or war on the ambassador. So it's always being dealt with in the realm of
relationship.
The Vedic literature will never deviate from this. It's the Mayavadi's misconception that there is some deviation, but all it is trying to establish relationship. That's all that's trying to be done. If you don't have these qualities, the ambassador doesn't have this quality, he won't establish proper rapport with the other kings. He won't understand who they are. Then he won't be able to do his service for his king. So everything comes back to relationship. You can't get around that. Is that... What do you think? Krishna, do you?
Another point is that sometimes things may appear to work, but the principles are based on not Krishna conscious at all. And the Jesus and Christ may become revealed.
Yes.
Like a lot of the modern ideas.
Yes, yes.
And they seem nice in theory. And the devotees even may adopt it.
Yes. Yes. That's a very good point, is that it works for a short time and then it doesn't. So it always must be brought back in line. That's our point. Because ultimately, we're not worried about expert management. We're not worried about anything. I mean, we see you had devotees, been in the movement a few months, didn't really know the Krishna conscious philosophy in great detail, and that didn't know, you know, we're not expert in so many things, but Prabhupada had taught them the essence. They knew the philosophy. They knew Krishna is God, I am his servant. My relationship with him is to do service, and the essence of that is chanting Hare Krishna and doing that with other people. So we must expand. And Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. So therefore the Shastras were nicely expanded. And then devotees would go out after a few months, open new temples, and they'd be successful. So we understand Krishna is actually the one that's doing things. Just if we have the interest in all that, then Krishna will reveal. As we become more sophisticated and more knowledgeable, then naturally, then the sophistication in what we're doing, Krishna expects you to do more. It's like the small child, the relationship with the father is very nice. But as the child grows, the relationship stays nice as long as the child starts to take advantage of those refined things. But if the kid's 20 years old and he still acts like a 2-year-old, the relationship is not going to be enhanced. So as we advance and become more mature and more responsible and more refined, then we also naturally would engage the finer aspects. And so the finest aspects we see in the Vedic culture. So it's very natural to take that. Very. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. 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 No, that's there. It will with time, because ultimately, if one doesn't, nothing will work. That's the point, is that the just everything working just because one's Krishna conscious works on when there's simplicity, humility, honesty, all these nice devotional qualities. If it's not there, then things aren't going to function very properly. So whether one's very expert or not very expert, you know, one's not expert, it's naturally not going to work. Even if one is expert, like you said, if the principles are wrong, what they're based on, the mentality is wrong. Even when it's expert, it won't happen, because Krishna is not pleased.
Raj, it seems like time is not enough of a concern for things to improve, because from my observation over the last 7-8 years, we've had this influx from CIS. We've had a lack of training. The standard has actually gone down, especially in terms of culture and etiquette. So it's not a matter of just waiting for things to improve with new brewers and things like that, but actually there has to be an incredible increase in training.
Yes. Well, that's a very good point. Because you see, in the Prabhupada always discusses about the centers as places of learning, places where people can come. He always talks about the devotees as his students. Very rare he calls them his disciples. They're always his students, because he is the teacher, he's training them in Krishna consciousness. So he would, in the beginning, train them in everything. We see that in, there's the Lilamrita, it's talking about Prabhupada's in San Francisco. It's just gone there and just started to establish things. And then he's shown one devotee how to practice the Mridanga. You know, I think they just how to do play Te De Keta, the first beat. And so Prabhupada's showing that kind of thing. And he takes pleasure in teaching that. It was interesting. The devotee was playing away. And like for 10 minutes, he had his eyes closed and he's trying to make everything work nicely. And when he opened his eyes after 10 minutes, Prabhupada was standing there and appreciating and all that. Because it was like the proper endeavor was there, the proper attitude. So Prabhupada was training, cooking. You know, he mentioned before, he taught the essence of the philosophy. He also taught the essence of cooking. Someone who really knows Indian cooking knows that what Prabhupada taught was the essence of that. You know, and it was so universal, you could cook any vegetable or any doll, anything in the way he's taught. Like that. And it was also, it wasn't that it was simple, but it wasn't unrefined or not high class. It was very aristocratic, the cooking he taught, but it was the simple side of it. You know, it wasn't that he taught some, you know, kid stuff. That's the interesting thing in the Vedic culture. When you begin teaching something, there's no such thing in the Vedic concept of education of kid stuff. It doesn't exist. It's all something that is very useful and practical in the adult world, but there are certain aspects that are simple, that don't take much to grasp. Those are taught to the youngest children. Those that have a little bit more elaborateness, those are taught to the children when they're a little older. And those that have very, you know, deep understanding of the concepts and philosophies and all those things, that is taught to the oldest, most qualified students. But there's no such thing as just kid stuff. It doesn't exist in the Vedic culture. Vedic culture is too practical to play around with kid stuff. Like that. They're not willing to waste their own children's time learning stuff that they're not going to use. They're going to always teach them stuff that is useful directly as it is in life. You know? They learn a mantra, like you want to teach the kids, you know, rhyme and melody. So you teach them actual songs or actual Vedic mantras that are useful in life. You don't teach them nursery rhymes or, you know, limericks or, you know, other things like this that they have no use in their life other than to teach to the next generation, you know, of young kids useless stuff. They just teach them solid stuff they can use in their life. But they just teach the simple. So Prabhupada did like that. He gave the essence of the philosophy, essence of the cooking, essence of the behavior, of the dress. I mean, if you look at old pictures, devotees who are wearing turbans, right? Before the British came in India, every man would wear a turban. They wouldn't not wear turbans. You always wore something on your head. The head was always covered. Turbans or some cloth on the head. The head was always covered. Like that. Vedic thing, even the men's head were covered, let alone the women's. Right? But with the British, then slowly, slowly that kind of went out. Then many transformed into hats, and then when that went out of fashion, it disappeared. You know? So you can see they're wearing turbans. They're wearing dhotis in ways that a few years later, devotees didn't even know how to wear. You'd only see it in India. You know, the way they tuck them in or tie them around their waist, like this. You know, many of them, they just, you know, the wearing of chudders. You know, Prabhupada said, always, he came to America, he's wearing chudders and all that. He's always wearing chudders in the beginning. So he's teaching all the essential points of the culture, how to serve prasad, how to eat prasad, conversation of prasad, and they wouldn't let it be too rough and nasty. So he gave the essence of the whole culture, philosophy, everything. Like that. So training was what was going on. He was teaching, you know, Kirtananda how to cook, he was teaching Jamuna how, he was always teaching somebody something. You know? Either philosophy or practical training. But then somehow or another that was missed. And the practical training somehow or another has disappeared. It was reduced down to then you have a special program just to teach that, the Bhakti program, but it's only 2 months long. But in that, they're not necessarily teaching these essential things. So, and then like this, then many places now the Bhakti programs don't exist. So now instead of the whole temple teaching everybody, then nobody teaches. Then you get like what you just said. So education is very, very important. Is that seven?
Seven.
Anything more on your side? Okay, so then we'll end here for the night. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki
jai.
Samavitha Bhaktivrinda ki jai. Jainitai Gaur Premanandi.